After this, Absalom got himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way of the gate. And when any man had a dispute to come before the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, "From what city are you?" And when he said, "Your servant is of such and such a tribe in Israel," Absalom would say to him, "See, your claims are good and right, but there is no man designated by the king to hear you." Then Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were a judge in the land. Then every man with a dispute or cause might come to me, and I would give him justice." And whenever a man came near to pay homage to him, he'd put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. Thus Absalom did to all of Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. And at the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king, "Please let me go and pay my vow, which I vowed to the Lord in Hebron. For your servant vowed a vow while I lived in Geshur in Aram, saying, 'If the Lord will indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will offer worship to the Lord.'" And the king said to him, "Go in peace." So he rose and went to Hebron. But Absalom sent secret messengers throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, "As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then say, 'Absalom is king at Hebron.'" With Absalom went 200 men from Jerusalem who were invited guests, and they went in their innocence and knew nothing. And when Absalom was offering the sacrifices, he sent to Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor, from his city at Geloa. And the conspiracy grew strong, and the people with Absalom kept increasing. And a messenger came to David saying, "The hearts of the men of Israel have gone after Absalom." And then David said to all of his servants who were with him in Jerusalem, "Arise, let us flee, or else there will be no escape for us from Absalom. Go quickly, lest he overtake us quickly and bring down ruin on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword." And the king's servants said to the king, "Behold, your servants are ready to do whatever the Lord the king decides." So the king went out and all his household with him, and the king left 10 concubines to keep the house. And the king went out and all the people after him, and they halted at the last house, or at the last house of the city. So basically he's out in the suburbs here, okay? And all his servants passed by him, and all the Cherethites and Pelethites and all the 600 Gittites who had followed him from Gath passed on before the king. And then the king said to Ittai the Gittite, "Why do you also go with us? Go back and stay with the king, for you are a foreigner and an exile from your home. You only came yesterday, and shall I today make you wander about with us since I go and I know not where? Go back, take your brothers with you, and may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you." Now check this out, gang. But Ittai answered the king, "As the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives, wherever my lord the king shall be, whether for death or for life, there also will be your servant." And David said to Ittai, "Go then, pass on." So Ittai the Gittite passed on with all his men and all the little ones who were with him. And all the land wept aloud as all the people passed by. And the king crossed the brook Kidron, and all the people passed on towards the wilderness. And Abiathar came up, and behold, Zadok came also with all the Levites, bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God. And they set down the Ark of God until the people all passed out of the city. And then the king said to Zadok, "Carry the Ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and let me see both it and his dwelling place. But if he says, 'I have no pleasure in you,' behold, here I am. Let him do to me what seems good to him." And the king also said to Zadok the priest, "Are you not a seer? Go back to the city in peace with your two sons, Ahimaaz your son and Jonathan the son of Abiathar. And see, I will wait at the fords of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me." So Zadok and Abiathar carried the Ark of God back to Jerusalem, and they remained there. But David, he went up to the ascent of the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went, barefoot, and with his head covered. And all the people who were with him covered their heads, and they went out weeping as they went. And it was told David, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, please turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. While David was coming to the summit where God was worshipped, behold, Hushai the Archite came to meet him with his coat torn and dirt on his head. And David said to him, if you go on with me, you will be a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I have been your father's servant in times past, so now I will be your servant. Then you will defeat for me the counsel of Ahithophel. Are not Zadok and Abathar the priests with you there? So whatever you hear from the king's house, tell it to Zadok and Abathar the priests. Behold, their two sons are with them there, Ahimaaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abathar's son, and by them you shall send to me everything you hear. So Hushai, David's friend, came into the city just as Absalom was entering Jerusalem. Now, if you've been with us as we've been going through this series, you are able, and that's why it's always nice to be consistent on these Wednesday nights, to be able to follow the story in a linear fashion. And if you've been here, you know that things had not been going well for Absalom for quite some time. Now, I bring that up not just as a passing comment, but that aspect is a very important thing for us to grasp in this story. That is, once again, that things had not gone well for Absalom for a very long time. And look at where we find Absalom here in 2 Samuel 15. He did not get there overnight. The events of 15 of 2 Samuel didn't happen on a dime or spur of the moment. These are his actions that are ultimately a reaction, okay, to events that had happened over time. Not one event, not simply, you know, a bad day. Multiple events in Absalom's life seems to now have accumulated to form the perfect storm. His situation is a result of everyone around him failing to do what should have been done, one after another, each sharing in the responsibility of Absalom being in this situation on this day. David, Amnon, Jonadab, Ahithophel, certainly Absalom himself. Everybody, it seemed now, had dropped the ball, and now we're here. Shock of shocks. One of the warnings that I've given as we've gone along in this, and we talked some along the way about parenting and our relationships as family and the dynamic in the home and all these things. And the thing that I keep bringing up over and over again is my kind of shock and awe that so many people just seem to ignore these warnings. No, not my kid. No, that won't happen to my kids. No, it's not going to happen to my kids. It'll be all right. I'll be all right. Except I've been doing this now for about 30 years. And you know what? It is happening to a lot of your kids. And it's happened to a lot of your kids. And so I keep warning. And the next generation, are they paying attention? Or will the warnings also go over their heads? I've emphasized you get one pass at this parenting thing. One shot. You better make it count. You can't go back and make them three again. Oh, I'm sure there are times you would like to. But this is the door of manifest. This is the fruition of a whole series of overt avoidance of doing what was right. Years of not doing what was right. There were six stages that led Absalom up to this point. The first one was that original wound. Back in 2 Samuel 13, if you were here, you recall the tabloidish story about Amnon and David. That was David's son by another woman, Abigail. And Absalom's brother, Amnon, rapes his half-sister, Absalom's full-sister, rapes Tamar, and then immediately casts her out like dirt. So at that point, if you recall, Absalom did nothing about that. He should have moved definitely, and he should have done immediately at that point, but he did nothing. His father David the king, Tamar's father, he also did nothing about this incestuous violation of his own daughter, Tamar. He did nothing. Now, we discussed at that time that was most likely because there was no doubt that guilty conscience that came hearkening back about his own similar action with Bathsheba some years before. Now, the second step two in this whole Absalom fiasco was in 2 Samuel 13. And there was then an attempt to rectify the situation. Oh, yes, albeit 2 years later, Absalom finally moved. Now, David, again, did not act to discipline Amnon in any way. So Absalom got to stew about this offense for 2 years. This thing just brewed inside of him. And then finally, he conspires to kill his brother Amnon, and he does that. So what we see herein is just a classic 2018 example of passive-aggressive action. Absalom was, at least at this time, what appears to be someone who had, I guess, a strong sense of justice. Now, it was either that or maybe it was, you know, far less vigilante justice. Maybe it was just a result of a personal action. Maybe it was just pure hatred and revenge due to the wound on himself. No, we don't know that. Are you with me? Did Absalom do this because he was avenging his sister's rape, or was Absalom doing this because essentially what this said to him? Messing with his sister was kind of messing with him. We don't know. But this wound had festered for 2 years, and it was unhealed either way. So finally, Absalom takes matters into his own hands, and with his men, he kills Amnon in revenge for raping his sister. So now Absalom is not just passive-aggressive, he's a murderer. So let me, if I get this straight, to punish a rapist, he becomes a murderer. Yeah, that's fine logic there, isn't it? But that's what happens. Third, despite his revenge, the wound continues to fester. This did not end it, nor does those things ever end it. We've said that before. You know what? I just need to get a divorce. That'll solve my problems. Yeah, that'll do it. You know, they just go away and never communicate with you again, do they? No. We think that these burning down the house kind of scenarios are going to make these problems go away, but they don't. So Absalom now needs to run because he killed his brother, so he flees to his grandfather's house, the king of Geshur, and he lives there for 3 years. This is his mother's father. So now Absalom, he did this. Why? Because like the rest of us, he is in a very vulnerable position right now. So he's seeking support. He's seeking solace. And again, he did what we inevitably do whenever we are in these kind of situations. And that is to seek out a sympathetic soul to support us in our cause. This is like clockwork. Whenever we get in a situation like this, is always to go and dig up somebody who will support us. Okay? I've had people in this church contact old people way back that used to go to this church that I didn't even know they knew. I don't think they did know him. But they had to dig far enough to find somebody who would side with them. You know? It's astonishing the depth and how far they'll go to find somebody who will say, yes, I agree with you. That terrible Jesus fellowship, yes. But we do that. We need solace. We need some support. And then, again, most of the time it doesn't matter who, as long as we have someone. Now, as long as that person would tell us that our actions are righteous and justified, and certainly Absalom was in a situation that he would have received that support. But does time heal all wounds? No. We'd like to believe that. I just need some time. I'll get over this. Yeah, not so much. That's not really the human way. New emotions now have joined the fray. Absalom's separation now, his time with his grandfather only, the wound just got worse. And now he had bitterness and he had anger. And I've always said on multiple occasions that I have discovered that the tricky thing about bitterness and angst and all these things, there is one emotion that trumps them all. Anger. If I can just get mad enough, I can trump all the other emotions. So I'm feeling bad. I just need to find a scapegoat and get angry at that person, and then I don't feel so bad over here. I'm bitter. I'm feeling guilty. Whatever the emotion might be, if I can just get mad, if I can just get angry, that will trump all other emotions. So people will just get hyped up and make up things because they need to be angry, because as long as they're angry, that'll cover all else, guilty feelings and all the rest. Anger trumps them all. So no, we got it. Bitterness and anger. He's pumped up. Then he goes on to step four, and that's the rejection. 2 Samuel 14. David now allows Absalom to return to Jerusalem to his own house, but not to David's house, nor to David's company. Okay, you can come back to Jerusalem, but keep him away from me. So David, King David, goes halfway in making this right, which, what does that get? Does that get a halfway solution? No, actually, that's gasoline on the fire. Ultimately, a halfway solution will only make things worse. It only will aggravate the situation. And we talked about this. We talked about this, I think, on Sunday about tweaking things, remember? Or was it last week? Just tweaking things. You know, instead of going, what this situation needs is burn this puppy down and start over again. Just a little, I'll just move this and fudge with this and tweeze this and duct tape there. There you go, that'll hold. Yeah, for about another 10 minutes and then you're going to be fixing it again. We need to take a deep breath and do what needs to be done. We're not so good at that. So halfway actions, they only aggravate the situation. Now, this compounds the pain that Absalom already had. Now he's got two wounds. The second wound is rejection from his father. So Absalom's getting pumped up. He's getting cranked up for this. Step five, the festering continues because there's no reconciliation. Because David would not go any further. Now Absalom, he pushes this scenario even via some schoolboy violence, remember, burnt that field down to get some attention. So already he's proving that he's willing to be violent and to do what needs to be done to satisfy his own. I'll just burn this guy's field down. I'll get some attention. So to get his father's back in his father's house, to get back in his father's graces, he pushes. And he still doesn't get in as far as he would like. A little bit further. Now Absalom, in the meantime, begins to hatch his own plan. And he is becoming a popular guy with everybody outside because he's a handsome guy. He's a good-looking guy. He's got charisma. I mean, this is big man on campus. He's got it going on. So finally, Again, David allows his son into his presence, but only on a formal level, not a familial level. He's not getting invited over for Thanksgiving and Christmas. He's just, you know, okay, we can live with each other. And this would naturally leave Absalom still wanting, still unsatisfied, still angst. That would be an itch that couldn't be scratched, and it was starting to have an ingrained and obsessive effect. Absalom was not a little boy anymore, and he was developing into a young man with some serious anger issues. Number six, lastly, the conspiracy begins. The final blow. As you see, there was many mistakes and many steps that led up to this. And finally, after he has a moment with his father, he has no real reconciliation. He gets no real redemption. Absalom is going to move in his flesh. Are you with me? That's what happens. I cannot get what I want. And I want what I want. I demand what I want. What I want is the right way. Everybody has to do it my way. And I don't get what I want. And so I'm going to use fleshly weapons. And I'm going to move on my own. And all that Absalom has left is to conspire and to betray his father. I will get what is mine. And I'm going to get it through force. Now, Absalom had obviously had a wounded spirit here. Proverbs 18:14 says, quote, "The human spirit can endure a sick body, but who can bear a crushed spirit?" End quote. The book of Hebrews describes the destructive power of bitterness. It speaks of what an unhealed wound will do, how it destroys not just ourselves, but all the people around us. Now, you know, you turn there, but let me read this to you. In Hebrews 15, verse 15 and 16 says this, "Work at living in peace with everyone. Work at living a holy life." Please note those two things, by the way. It's all right, Christian. You can work at it. Another message, but "For those who are not holy will not see the Lord. Look after each other so that none of you fails to receive the grace of God. Watch out that no poisonous root of bitterness grows up to trouble you, corrupting many." That's what bitterness does. But you see, it seems that Absalom at least felt that he had nowhere to go and nowhere to turn to. I don't know if that's true or not, but his actions seem to reflect that at least he felt he had nowhere else to go. So what was Absalom to do? When life and situations leave us wounded, and life and people and situations are hard to live with, we have to know what to do with the pain. We have to know what to do with that angst, or we will find ourselves in Absalom's shoes. And if you think that you're immune, you're fooling yourself, because there have been people that have graced these pews in the past 30 years that, let's put it this way, the security that we have in the church will stop them before they get in the doors, because we deem them dangerous. And it's 2018. Bitterness will find a root in our lives and will be consumed like a cancer, because bitterness is not static. Along the way in this journey, if we are running down that road, we will hurt many people that we love. We will also drag down in hatred those very people that we have animosity against, And you say, that may be fine and dandy, but I'm talking about literally years after the fact, and I am astonished. People who probably don't even remember the event that fired them up in the first place. People who certainly don't remember other people amongst us that don't remember what happened there. We've moved on in our lives. Now we're living in joy and we're living in peace now. You know, and these people can end up hurting you. And you don't even know what's going on. You don't even know what the fight is. And you know why? Because the fight's over. The battle's over. I mean, there are some people that are just absolutely alone in the battlefield. They're fighting ghosts. They're warring invisible demons that exist only in their heads and only in the past. Everybody's went home. You're the only one left on the field fighting. There's nobody there. The war is over. We've all gone home. Go home now. Get over it. It's been 20 years. What's the answer to this? Well, the answer is that we have to take all of our stuff, all of our anger, all the reasons we were hurt, and I'm not saying you weren't legitimately hurt. What people have done to us, how we were mistreated, how we were betrayed, how we failed, all of it, and we got to take it and leave it at the foot of the cross of Christ. Now, you may say, yeah, Tim, that is such a cliche. But the truth of that remains, and there's no other way to put it. Unless we give it all to Christ, we are, in essence, holding back on our Savior and holding back on our Lord. And if you're a born-again Christian today, your life belongs to Him now. You are no longer your own. You are a bond slave. Hence, slave, I'll emphasize that. He owns you. You belong to Him. And so when we hold on to this stuff, we're holding out on God. And the fact that we do that simply reflects an unthankful heart. It reflects a lack of understanding of just what redemption is, what salvation means, what discipleship means, what being Him Lord of our life means, what forgiveness means. It just simply shows a lack of understanding and quite frankly, quite likely shows that we're simply not born again. Because we're keeping back from God. And the Bible speaks of that, is that when we keep something back, when we have something that we believe to be ours and ours alone, even if it's anger, bitterness, and a vengeful spirit, if we're holding on to that, there is then something before God, between you and God. That's called an idol. Have no other gods before me. And when we hang on to it, you got a new God, a new control, a new aspect. Do you want bitterness to be your God? What a terrible God. Do you want anger to be Lord of your life? What a terrible Lord. And these issues, according to Scripture, clearly and emphatically will cost us our eternity. And again, you don't need to turn there. Just listen. You want to take notes, that's fine. 1 John 3:15. Whoever hates his brother is a murderer. Did you know the Bible said that? Whoever hates his brother is a murderer, and you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. What is that saying? If you hate your brother, you are lost. If you hate your brother, you are not a Christian. If you hate your brother, you are going to hell. Period. I find that to be a great motivator in my life, by the way. See, I'm not immune to that either. It's like, no, Lord, I don't want to be angry. I don't want to be bitter. Help me to love them. I've learned to pray for people like that. I did because I don't want to lose my standing with God because of that. If you're truly saved, you're truly born again, then you have it within you the ability to forgive. even if it's for your own good. 1 John 4:20. If someone says, I love God, and he hates his brother, he's a liar. I wish these verses were clear, right? If you say you love God and you hate your brother, you're a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he has not seen? 1 John 2:11. As you can see, if you're not into this, stay away from 1 John. 1 John 2:11. But he who hates his brother is in darkness and walks in darkness, does not know where he's going because the darkness has blinded his eyes. Ouch. Kind of some damning passages there, isn't it? Now, because Absalom didn't deal with his heart on these issues, the darkness overtook him, consumed him and his life. His actions weren't simply immoral, and they weren't, you know, we always go, well, it's not a big deal, man. I'm under grace, right? And it's just a missing the mark. It's just a sin, a missing of the mark, you know? No. That's you're misdiagnosing. His actions were one of conspiracy and required much planning. Now, that's a different word in the Bible. That's transgression. Back to the epistles of John again. That, transgression, sin, says you're not saved. Again, look it up. You don't have to take my word for it. That's called a knowing sin. Absalom contrived these events quite a while too, man. He really played it out. I mean, it was quite a role. And he thought them out. He planned their execution. Absalom had somewhere and at some point decided that he was justified in his actions via any and every method. I see that. I mean, he'd been wronged after all, right? You don't understand, Pastor. That's easy for you to say. You don't know what that person did to me. If that had happened to you, Pastor, let me tell you, you'd be standing up too, boy. You'd be fighting too, if you only knew. And then my mind floods with the scenes of the arrest of Jesus Christ. He could have stopped them breathing with a blink of his eyes, just sucked all the air out of there, dropped them where they stood, and he didn't do it. And they beat him, the Bible says, to a point where you could not recognize that he was even a man. And then they nailed him up to a cross and murdered him. While we were yet sinners, Christ died. See, Absalom thought he was justified. He thought he was righteous. And that just factually wasn't the case. I don't care. Don't give me any of this. Well, in my childhood, oh, I had a hard time. Oh, I had this terrible thing. Oh, come on, gang. Who hasn't? Any of you just have a little Mary Poppins life? Come on. That's why Jesus died, because we had to have salvation. We needed salvation. We required salvation. Today we have online social media slander. I was actually, misery loves company. I was really happy to, yeah, this is terrible, terrible of me. Okay, just tell you how bad your pastor is. I was kind of happy this week because I was reading Matt Chandler just getting raped on this site. We're just absolutely destroying him, you know. It's like, oh, good. Misery loves company. I'm right out there with Matt Chandler, you know. It's not enough that Jesus got slandered. Oh, no. As long as Matt Chandler got slandered, you know, that makes me feel better. Online social media, revenge through property and material damage. How about some good old-fashioned drive-by shootings, road rage, spousal abuse, innumerable social attacks through gossip, lies, innuendo? You don't have to prove anything these days. Did you notice that? I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on out there. Do I think some of these people are guilty? Yeah, that is a good possibility. Did they prove it? Nope. And last time I checked, we still live in America. And I sure hope that I get my day in court if I get accused. Do you understand how fearful I am as a pastor? None of you ladies are ever going to be in my office with the door closed. I don't care how good a friend you are. I ain't giving you the chance to accuse me. That's the world we live in. Fearful. The methods and the avenues are endless. Now, I know a lot of folks who have claimed, and some yet still claim to be a Christian, that have kept these hot embers going, a bitterness and a revenge, and they've done it for years. Some now, sadly, for decades. And their overt spewing of hatred, of course, excludes them from the faith, according to the Word of God. Not some weird JFB doctrine, just the Bible. But what is so sad is that, again, they're the only one left on the battlefield. I just want to say, dude, go home. We've all left now. I'm almost 58. That was a long time. Go home. Live your life. Love your kids. Really? Is this it? This is your life? For us, there is no war. The war is over. But for these folks, old pastor friend of mine said, bitterness is like a Twinkie. As you can unwrap that puppy 20 years from now, and it's just as sweet and yummy as it was in the beginning. So bitterness and anger eventually and universally is our downfall. And every time it's going to have the same effect, it will eat us up like a cancer. I've seen it practically drive people crazy. I've seen it consume their lives, cost them their marriage, their family relationships, destroy their vocational livelihood, steal all their joy, all the beauty of life that God's given. They just can't stop long enough to go, what a wonderful day it is. Did you see the stars last night? Said, no, I haven't seen no stars. Yeah. And in the end, they become dangerous to themselves and to others around them, and they end up being on security watch lists. Absalom would appear to have gotten his revenge in this chapter. We can look at this and it's like, well, I guess, you know, he scored. He got it. Yeah, but the problem is those of us that have read this passage before, we all know that in a few chapters we're going to see things like, oh, this is, it's we're going to find out that victory like this can be quite fleeting. Because what Absalom meant for evil, God meant for good. And in the end, hear me tonight. In the end, the winner is going to be who the winner always is. And that's God. God's going to win. Last time, this time, and every time. You can't beat the house. For David, the end result will be a very different picture than that of Absalom. We read in Psalms, and I'm getting windy tonight, so I don't have time to go there. But in Psalms, we have what we know of as the exile Psalms. And through those writings, you can't help but see that despite the persecution, despite the difficulties he endured, he actually came out of that with a greater enduring trust in God. He came to a greater conviction, no matter how crazy things got, how emotionally under the weight of all this he felt, that God was still on the throne and he knew it. And God is still on control and still on the throne tonight, gang. I encourage you, and I was going to read it, but again, I don't have time. Psalms 3 and 4 is a perfect example of David's exile psalms. It's beautiful. I cannot help believe that on a subject matter like this, in a group even this size, holiday season, that's fine, even this size, this has got to hit home. This is not a small passing issue. This isn't something rare. It's not like malaria, okay? I mean, this is like catching the common cold. This is easy to get. Who is it tonight? Family member? Ex-spouse? Ex-friend? Is it this church? Is it me? It doesn't matter. Because the loss will be yours. And sadly, you will take people down with you. Probably your family. Anger and bitterness is a sin. I'm not saying it's easy to get over. I encourage you to remember what's important. Just like Christmas conversation I had at the beginning. Because, you know, 75 years from now or whatever, it won't matter anymore, will it? Because you'll be dead. And the power of Christ can do anything. Do you know that this evening? And this is a chronic issue, and I wish it was only outside there in the world, but it comes in here, and the devil uses this quite effectively over and over and over again. And I'm not kidding you that there's people in this town that it's been better than 20 years. Yeah, you'll know. If they know you, they'll catch you. They'll have a conversation with you. It's like, oh, for God's sakes, you're the only one left fighting. You know, turn on the camera. Does it look like we lost? It's over now. Go love Jesus and love your family and get over. Because your anger and your bitterness is going to take you to hell. And that would be sad. It's a lot of Sunday mornings you lost for nothing. This is something we need to deal with. I don't want you to be Absaloms. Okay?